Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 369, I chat with personal cinema architect John Bishop about replicating the cinema experience at home. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by Cashfly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded August 31st, 2017. Episode 369, Bringing Cinema Home. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week, we have John Bishop returning. He's the founder and president of Bishop Architectural Entertainment Services. Hey, John, welcome back.
Hey, Scott. Good to be here.
Thanks for coming back for part two of our discussion. We got so deep into aspect ratios last week that we didn't cover all so much other stuff that you wanted to talk about and I wanted to talk about with you. So really appreciate you coming back for part two.
The frame is one of the most important parts of the picture, so we spend a little time on it.
Indeed. Those who are watching live at live.twit.tv can join the chat room there or at irc.twit.tv, and you can then post questions as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So today we wanted to talk about applying commercial cinema standards to home theaters or home cinema, as you call it, to try and replicate the commercial cinema experience at home as much as possible, because that's really the goal of home theater, right?
Yes, indeed. I look at it as an art form, and maybe one of the most important, because if you look at fine art, and you look at literature, and you look at the art of music, you know, the fundamental things that sort of move our souls, make us, feel great or terrible or whatever the intent of the art might be. That's all in movies. I mean, movies have a story. They're narrative. Movies have visual images that are frame by frame sometimes art. If you look at Lars von Trier's Breaking of the Waves, his scene transitions are pieces of art. And there are a lot of movies where you just look at one frame and usually the director will stop on that frame a moment, especially if it's a transition frame. And it's a piece of art. You could put that in a frame and enjoy it as simply a piece of fine visual art. So movies can be trivial. You know, Georges Méliès, Man in the Moon, that was a new entertainment form, but the entertainment component really became the art, became the literature, became the commentary on society, all kinds of things. Movies have changed the world at different times. So they're an important art form. And I say that because how important is music? We look at high-end audio and the most expensive speakers we can afford and the electronics, you know, to complement them and the highest resolution music so we can sit in a space and transport ourselves to a concert, to a live experience in our homes. And that's a really important thing and an exciting thing. Well, movies are that and more because there's the visual component and the story's being told. So I think it's the target is what is the art? And I believe the art is what the director designed it to look like and sound like in a professional exhibition. The best
commercial theater, cinema.
A commercial cinema. A private screening room done to the commercial cinema standards, a DCI screening room. There are things and characteristics that go into designing those, executing, and then experiencing them that are distinctive from what we're used to in home theater. And when you focus on those distinctions, you'll design differently. And that's kind of where this comes from. And I call it architectural cinema. Again, I talked about elevating it to sort of a kind of a higher level in terms of performance. And you invited me on in November. I consider that part one. And last week was part two. And now we're part three of architectural cinema.
That's, okay.
That's really, we laid a lot of foundation in the first two shows, and we'll try to kind of simplify it so that anybody, whether they were geeks or just people who enjoy movies and the arts, will be able to understand what we're talking about, what's different about it.
Good deal.
Now, if I may, I suggested I might try something here that I don't think, this may be a Home Theater Geeks first. I've got a kaleidoscape here, which allows me to cue things up. And I've created a scene, and this is very apropos to our discussion last week, where we looked at Dunkirk and what the different exhibition qualities were between, you know, 15 perf 70 millimeter, conventional 70 millimeter, DCI, and 6P 4K laser. So you'll maybe enjoy this little clip, because this is the movie Mrs. Miniver, which was 1942. And this is a scene that I labeled Return of the Armada. So this is the end of Dunkirk. And this is a gentleman who took his private boat, answered the call, Churchill's call, the country's call, and he's now returning to Dunkirk. And there's two reasons for showing you this clip. One is the connection to Dunkirk. It's a classic movie. In fact, this movie caused Casablanca, the folklore at least says, to delay their screening that qualified for them for the Oscars, because they thought Mrs. Miniver was going to kick their tush. Mrs. Miniver did take the Oscar in their year. So there's a boat and a guy that looks pretty beat up. And this clip, anybody can go get this movie and take a look at it. You'll notice two things. One, I have it framed on my 2.55:1 screen in 1.33:1, which is the aspect ratio of this movie. And I have it masked. So you see that black edge to the movie. It makes it look better. To the left is my 2.35:1 TV. And of course, it doesn't have masking. And you can see, of course, it's an LCD, so there's an elevated black on the bars. But the quality of the image just can't compete. It wouldn't matter if everything else was the same. If I pull that masking back, it diminishes the quality of the image just a little bit.
You're talking about the masking on the projection screen now, the one in the center of this image.
On the projection screen, yes. And in fact, let me just do it. I'm gonna walk up to the screen. I've got the cord. This is gonna be another Home Theater Geeks first, I think.
Yeah.
Let me just move it out of the way. See if you can see the difference on the screen.
Okay. So you're up there near the screen now, and you're about to pull away the masking. Oh, and look at that!
Just on one side.
Okay. Yeah. So we can see the difference between one side and the other.
Not even close to the quality of the other side.
Yeah.
This is a manual masking system. I maxed out the width of my screen for my room. There wasn't room for a motorized masking system. So, you know, my wife, Cindy, is very handy. She built me a manual masking system with a hard edge that I can move to each aspect ratio. Mm. Now, you can't hear this sound.
Which is fine.
Except, listen to this clip, Scott, and you'll know where Hans Zimmer and Christopher Nolan got that low droning sound that goes continuously
in Dunkirk.
I guarantee you they watched this movie and took notes, because that sound is what they basically transformed as the baseline sound throughout the entire movie Dunkirk. Okay,
so let's give it a little listen here.
That part was over.
All right. By the way, just for people's information, Kaleidoscape is a movie server, very high end, very expensive movie server that basically plays Blu-rays and now Ultra HD Blu-rays at their full resolution, having stored them on the server. They went through some legal troubles a couple of years ago, but they've now managed to figure out a way to do that legally. And you can pick, as John just did, you can pick any clip you want and mark it and play it and have it queued up. And that's pretty cool. So thanks for showing us that.
And in fact, if you can see on the TV, the beautiful thing about it is all of your movies are there. And what I do, besides seeing the pictures of the movies, is for training purposes, I've got all of my movies organized in collections. And every collection, you might even be able to see it on the screen, is organized by aspect ratio. So there's all my 1.85 movies. There's all my 2.10 to 1 movies. How many movies are there in 2.10 to 1?
Not many. Well, I can't think of a one.
There's one.
What is it?
And that picture is there. It's the Big Trail. That was John Wayne's first movie, his debut.
Wow.
What's interesting, Home Theater Geeks should get this Blu-ray because on the Blu-ray, there are two movies. It's the only movie that was ever filmed simultaneously by two different directors of photographer in two aspect ratios. 35 millimeter was 1.33 to 1. And they shot 65 millimeter negative. It was the first widescreen movie besides the Abel Gantz three camera movie. And it was 65 millimeter with an aspect ratio of 2.1 to, you know, almost the 2.2 and most 70 millimeter movies.
Yeah.
And if you compare the two, you'll see the black levels, you know, the film elements that they went back to create the Blu-ray. And they took a lot of care, shows what happens when you start with a higher resolution. You start with 70 millimeter film and you look at that on the Blu-ray and the black levels and dynamic range is much better than the 35, which is not bad. None of it's bad considering it was a on-site, you know, a non-studio production. It was out in the field, the whole thing.
Right.
So
I have to mention just as a side and an aside here, you mentioned this movie, they shot with two different cameras and two different aspect ratios simultaneously. There were other movies, more famous ones, like, for example, I'm pretty sure Oklahoma was one where they actually shot at 35 millimeter and then went back and shot it again in 70 millimeter.
I did not know that. They often, you know, like Sleeping Beauty you know, that's an animation created. And it was created in 2.55 to 1 scope. But in exhibition, they transferred that creation to 35 millimeter and showed it in 2.35 to 1 in theaters. And in 70 millimeter, they showed it in 2.2 to 1 in theaters, the roadshow version. Mm-hmm. And what we have on the Blu-ray is a 2.55 to 1. They went back to the original negatives and grabbed the 2.55, transferred negative to positive from the 70 millimeter, but the 65 millimeter negative. So we have in Sleeping Beauty the original aspect ratio that the animators created it in. So we see it in a way they never saw it in the day it came out in the early 60s, I think it was. I think that's a 62-ish movie or roundabout.
Well,
so, yeah.
But then again, there again we get to the question of what was the director's intent. They shot it, quote unquote, shot it since it's animated in one aspect ratio, but they presented it in a different aspect ratio. So what was the director's intent? Was it the way it was, quote unquote, shot or the way it was presented in the theater?
Well, I would say Christopher Nolan has and maybe Quentin Tarantino, we've talked about them both, have their preferences. So it's delivered so it can be shown in theaters as they exist. So the best 35 millimeter houses, the 70 millimeter houses, and in today's digital world, 6P laser on down. And I think the directors like it the best in the best venue. And the rest of it is how did they frame it? What was their colorimetry? You know, what are we doing at home that is different than what they intended? That's where the real departure comes when you you play something in high dynamic range that wasn't created with that intent, and nothing prior to 2015 was created in high dynamic range intent. So there's a library of tens of thousands of movies that we should be able to play as the director intended in our in our theaters. That's what we try to do. So
Let's get to you know, the bringing the commercial cinema experience home. You wanted to start that discussion, I think, with defining what is the cinema experience.
Yes. So let us go to the one that's labeled 100-point cue of experience, the quality of experience. That's a document that might get our thinking started. So the automotive world and the wine world have systems to help people understand what the quality of a car or a bottle of wine is. And they both happen to use a 100-point system. Wine Spectator, the Ferrari Club of North America, which takes their rating system from some standards bodies in Europe, create this rating system. So here's my, I've got it 0 to 10, so times 10. It's a 0 to 100. And along the top and along the bottom, I've kind of got a little milestone. So on the far left at the top, it says living room television, an LCD or a plasma. Relative to the director's intent for a theatrical experience, that's in the 30s. That's not really a theatrical experience. If you go to a larger TV, you move forward. So there you go. If you want to get into the 60s, a standard Cineplex is in the 60s. If you go into large format, there are some low quality large format and IMAX has the biggest screens. So if the projector isn't up to snuff, that experience gets kind of diminished. So it's a matter of brightness and contrast. I told you last week, the 15 perf 70 millimeter experience I had at the IMAX I went to happened to be poor because the setup of the film going through the projector was kind of poor. If you go back to the graph, we get to the interesting area, and that is down at the bottom, large format in a Cineplex. So these would be the 60-foot screens with good horsepower on them. And that tends to be when you get into that size range DLP because they've got more horsepower per watt than Sony's.
By horsepower, we're talking about light coming off the screen. So how much light can they throw onto the screen and how much
correct, and
how much light's coming back and hitting the audience?
And you can have higher gain screens. Cinema screens are typically at the minimum a little under a gain of 1.7, something like that, 1.5. Only in the finest places and in post-production do you get unity gain or low gain screens. Most of them are silver because of Avatar. They converted to silver, and those screens are 2.5 to 3. A gain of 2.5 to 3. So you see the hot spot.
Let me just make sure everybody understands that silver screens preserve polarization, which is how most 3D movies are presented in commercial cinema, with polarized light. The left eye is polarized one way, the right eye is polarized the opposite way. You need a silver screen so that the light hitting the screen comes back to the audience and it's still polarized in the way it needs to be in order to, when you wear the glasses, only the right eye comes into the right eye image comes into the right eye, and same with the left. Now, gain, just to make sure everybody understands that, is a measure of how much light gets brought back into the audience. And when you have a high gain, unity gain is basically the screen reflects in all directions, whereas a higher gain, like 2 or 3, like John was saying, the light is more focused and comes back in a specific direction, but leads to problems like hot spotting. So the center of the screen looks brighter than the sides of the screen. So there are all sorts of things to consider when you're talking about screen gain. I just wanted to make sure we were all on the same page on that, John.
That's all very good. So I'll say, if you go back to that graph, the top end is what's interesting. So the Samuel Golden is a reference theater. Mastering labs that do things right in general, they have a higher spec in the DCI standard. Review rooms have a higher spec. Their screen uniformity, center to edge, is 90, has to be within 5%. And in theaters, they can be off by 25%. You can have a corner that's 25% dimmer than the center by definition. And that acknowledges the high gain screens. That they just have to say, okay, that's acceptable. But a StudioTech 100, a SnowMat screen, unity gain with a projector in the right distance from it, not too close, so that it's a you know, a column of light hitting it and not a fan of light, can have nearly perfect uniformity. Center to corner could be within 2 or 3%, you know, that you'd have to measure it because your eye won't see it. That's when you really get interesting. And, you know, we saw the Dunn Academy Theater. That's a reference cinema. I'd say maybe in some ways a little bit better than the Samuel Goldwyn, just because it's a smaller house. I think it's a 350 seat theater with a screen size that's more appropriate for every seat. Whereas at the Samuel Goldwyn, 1,000 seats, they've got row, you know, behind row 18 and it goes out to 24. You're really, it's just a diminishing screen size. So that experience is, and that's not where people tend to sit. That's where the camera people set up when they're archiving an event there. So, and then finally you have the boutique cinemas like Cinepolis in Southern California. So that's the boutique art cinema. I would put the New Beverly Cinema. Quentin Tarantino is the benefactor of that theater in Hollywood. That is a, you know, a repertory theater that does things right. And he has made his entire private library available to them. So the screenings there are very interesting. I would say pay attention to that space. Once in a while, they do some very interesting things there. And it's not all Quentin Tarantino stuff, Scott. So you can go. You'll find interesting programs.
Oh, good. Thank you very much. I'm glad to hear that.
His private library has 7 of his films and I'm sure 700 of other films that are, you know, film, best quality film in the can, you might say. So, so those are the benchmarks. Now, if you go back to, you know, the Ferrari Club and Wine Spectator, I'm giving you a number for the theatrical experience, the quality of the cinema experience. That's very subjective. But if you back into the components like the car rating system does, and it says, you know, we're measuring this against perfection. So the showroom perfect car that came off the showroom in 1966, you know, a Ferrari Daytona, looked this way. Now let's look at your restoration. And if they find that the owner's manual has a flaw, they take points off. It's very hard to get a 100-point car at Pebble Beach. And when you do, it commands a lot of money. But they look at each category. They look at the engine compartment, the interior, the paint, the exterior, underneath every single detail, the labels, the serial numbers, all the badging, every single detail. And they start with a perfect car and subtract points for every flaw. So we do have a reference, and that reference is the best example of cinema, cinema science, the way they create it in review rooms and the way it's shown in the most revered rooms around. So I'd say Cinepolis and some of the private theaters around Hollywood would be the reference. So I'd say that sets the stage for us to look at the individual categories. So why don't we look at screens first? So there is a Pro Cinema.
There's one called Screen CSMS Parameters.
This is the one.
Okay.
Thank you for helping me with my own thing.
No problem. Before we get to that, Emily the Strange has a quick question. The word silver in silver screen. Remember, you hear it all the time about, I'm up on the silver screen. I mean, the screens, at least the 3D screens, are in fact silver in color. And the early screens, I think the early cinema screens were also silver in color in order, because that's a higher gain. It gets more light back into the audience. Am I right about that?
You're absolutely right. It was silver paint. A very specific silver paint. I've got an old screen.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I've got an old screen that dates back to the 20s and, you know, a home screen that's in a wooden box and it you know, a couple of wooden arms come out to hold the screen up and you roll it into a square shape. Not 1:3:3:1. It's a square screen with the original silver paint on it. I think it was a Kodak. I think it was something that they sold with their projectors of the day for 8 and 16 millimeter home movies.
Right. But the projectors of the day didn't put out nearly as much light as they do now. And so there needed to be a way to get more light back into the area where the viewers were sitting. And that's why they used silver material.
Yep.
Okay. Sorry. Just wanted to get Emily's question in there. But let's go ahead back to the... Screen CSMS. There we go.
Okay, why don't we reduce the size just a little bit to get a little bit more on the screen there, Josh, if you would. Now let's scroll down, and we'll end up going by this page. So this is just screen surfaces. You know, it's a cinema-grade evaluation. If you look at screens the way cinema engineers look at them, what are the things that they look at? Now, my top bar there, so these green lines are my parameters. The overall cinematic experience level is kind of where I would place it if all the things below add up. So the first thing is that it has a neutral reflectivity. You know, you want the color that hits it to come back with no change. So that's the first and foremost thing. And what we don't look at as carefully in home screens as in cinema screens is neutral spectral reflectivity by angle. So if we go and calibrate a projector by pointing our meter at a spot on the screen, you know, at a point perpendicular down.
Perpendicular to the screen, yeah.
Particularly the screen, we can calibrate it, and we can make all those little bars perfect over the entire color range. However, change the angle of that meter by 5 degrees or 10 degrees or 20 degrees. And depending on the type of screen, those bars will start jumping all over the place. And if one color jumps differently than another, like a red shift, which is typical of the what I call conference room screens, the ambient light rejecting screens, you can't calibrate it because the calibration at one point isn't the same as the color returned to you at another point. And I'm talking about 5 degrees different. Like the person sitting next to you doesn't see the same picture. Now, those are subtle things, but in cinema, that's critical. Stewart developed a screen. They never were in that game. They had Firehawk, which had a uniform reflectivity, which is the goal number one, but it had luminance uniformity issues. It's brighter in the middle and darkens to the edges, which is how it rejects light. That's the trade-off you make. But the colorimetry was a constant. Now they've got one that rejects the light at a much higher angle, plus or minus 30 degrees, with a lot of rejection. But still, you can be – the half angle is 120, 60 degrees, which means you can have a 120-degree viewing cone where the furthest person off axis is seeing a dimmer picture. It's half the brightness, but they don't know it. It just looks like it's half as bright. But they see a uniform image, and the colorimetry is constant. That's a critical thing. Not that you would ever use that screen for a movie environment. But at least when you are using it and the sun goes down, it's not an absurd compromise. It's a reasonable compromise, and it allows you to view things in the day. So that's the trick there. So let's go back to the graphic and take a peek here. So flat field uniformity is the next one, and that is the most important thing that we don't really address much in consumer. In the commercial world, they not only want the image to be the same brightness across the screen, they want the white to be pure white, no color infusion in that, but they want it to be constant per angle. And because they use gain screens, it can't be constant per angle. So what they do is they shade the seating and they say, this is the range of seats that have that meet the cinema spec, that the light drop off has not been such that it's out of spec. And it's basically a backwards horseshoe going up into the seating. As you get outside that horseshoe, the fact that you're off axis of a screen that's got gain causes the light to drop off, and in some screens, even the colors to shift a bit. But that's how cinema looks at it. It's a very critical parameter. If we go on to the next thing, speckle and sheen are things, you know, when you create gain, you have to do it with chemicals and optics, and that creates a speckle, a little tiny. We used to use flecks of mica to create to compress the light forward instead of having it go omnidirectional into the room, forward to the audience. So it's the same amount of light, but it's concentrated where the viewers are, so it looks brighter. But that speckle is an artifact. And the sheen is, if you look at a screen, a lot of screens you can walk up to with just white light on it, and it looks like almost like you're looking at a stop sign. It's got this sheen and this speckle to it, and to me that's a hard screen to look at. The best screens look like chalk, a matte, and you don't see any characteristic. You just see the image created by the pixels you projected onto it. That's the goal, and that's the reference screens in grading and editing rooms, soundstage screens and so forth. Don Stewart showed you a lot of sound stages when he was on in November, and those screens were all neutral white. You could tell in the snapshots that they were a reference screen quality. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go back to that chart, and we'll go down to, you know, slow pan edge sharpness is an issue. Fabric screens and perforated screens will have an issue if you have very thin lines or the corners of a building and the camera pans. That's basically an image moving across the screen. And the fabric, you start to see the texture of the fabric, and there's a twitter, a little, you know, edge noise.
Kind of a shimmering.
Shimmering or just like an edge artifact on every sharp edge because the screen's not flat. The other issue is that a non-flat surface scatters light. Individual pixels will scatter light. It doesn't matter if they're all white, but imagine a black pixel surrounded by white pixels. We talked about that in terms of adjacent pixel contrast. Screen that isn't perfectly smooth will scatter the light of those white pixels into the black pixel. That's a measure of resolution. That is how visually cinema engineers decide that they're meeting the spec that they need. That's how the DCI spec was partly created. Let's go back to the document, and we'll move down to examples, right? So resolution, the depth of modulation limits, that's a term that Joe Kane brought to us in his trainings. That has to do with retaining that contrast right down to the pixel level. There are optical engineering terms like the modulation transfer function that people use to literally take a picture of a graph with very fine lines, know the contrast between those white and black lines, and then reproduce it through the cinema process, either on film or digitally, and see how many lines can you see, and is the contrast between the black and white retained? Mm-hmm. And if it was 100% of the original, it would be a 100 MTF, 100. No such thing. But you try to get as close as you can. Okay, right. Let's go down quickly. We'll just look at, this is the reference screen that I use, the StudioTech 100. And by all of these parameters, it's what Hollywood uses and says it is the best. So it has to be the 100. That is the theoretical best. Now, if you go down and you add gain to a screen, you keep going to the next page, you'll see it top off again. There you go. Studio Gray 70 is exactly the same characteristic, but it is a fractional gain. It loses 30% of its light to absorption, but it's otherwise a chalk white, a chalky screen, just like SnowMat is. It's identical in its characteristics. It's just a tool to adjust net light output. If a projector is overly bright or the screen too small, that was one way we worked around those issues.
Now, if you it looks like it's got a rating of 10 throughout as well.
It's the same type of material. It simply has fractional gain. Everything else about it's the same.
Okay. So in other words, it doesn't return as much light to the viewing area as the 100.
Right. It's like a set of gray cards for photography. The pure white card and then one f-stop down. This is not a full f-stop. That would be 50. But at 70, it's a part of an f-stop. But every other part of the characteristic is the same, just less light comes back.
All right.
Now, but the next screen is adding gain. So this is StudioTech 130, right? So there's gain. Right off the bat, you see that.
By the way, just to make sure everybody understands, StudioTech, the way Stewart specs its screens and its models, 130 means a gain of 1.3, which isn't very much, but it does return more light into the viewing area than a StudioTech 100. And therefore, it will not have as good flat field uniformity, which we're about to see.
Right. Yeah. So if so it's a rational thing to derate it a little bit. There's a gain surface, so the spectral reflectivity is going to be changed slightly, but not much. You're going to get back, but at off axis, there's going to be an effect there. And I'd say that Mark Robinson could probably chime in and tell me I'm right or wrong on that one. But the flat field uniformity is unquestionably an issue, so it comes down a little bit. There is a speckle and sheen. When you're adding gain, there's something going on there. So those issues enter into the equation. The question is, to end up with 30% gain, did you engineer the best possible way to get there? Or did you put a gain surface on there that got you there but has higher sheen or higher speckle or higher? That's the trick. If you're engineering the chemistry of the screen from the ground up, which is unique to Stuart Film Screen, they literally at one end of their campus, trucks with liquid chemicals show up and drop their load, and at the other end, finished screens come out. I don't know that there's another screen company in the world that that is that vertically integrated.
Right.
Okay, let's move on now, and we'll just look at another. Josh, just scroll down, and we'll see different screens. Keep scrolling, and you'll see how. Just look at the arrows, right? So that screen, you know, there's some sheen on that screen. Keep going to page 70 down there, and you'll see this is a Firehawk. So Firehawk has some real compromises. In order to make it work, those are the kinds of compromises that happen. To reject ambient light means you're doing something on axis. So when the sun down goes down, there's a compromise there. And if you go down to the next one, this is a more dramatic, this is a conference room screen. So these dramatically reject ambient light and dramatically affect the visual properties of the screen. So I'd say we've got enough on this one. Let's go to the one that's labeled projectors. Well, okay, this is microperf. You know, you just stopped there. So what happens with microperf? Scroll on
and
down.
By the way, microperf is when you take a flat screen surface, you poke a bunch of tiny holes in it in order to have the speaker behind the screen so that the sound can come through the screen. This is how all commercial cinemas work. And this is what Stuart does for home cinema
Hold it right there, Josh, or go up slightly. There you go, right there. Okay, so look at all the arrows that are still pegged. And the reason is where there aren't holes, there's a perfect screen surface, right? So the holes lose a little bit of light that go through the holes, lets the sound come through. That's the point. But other than that, it has perfect flat field uniformity, specular mitigation. There's no speckle. There's none of those. Now, slow pan edge detail. Yes, the edges of buildings, very sharp, single line, single pixel lines. You will see the effect if you're close enough to see it of the fact that you're going over the holes. Now, if you go to the next one, I think I've got a fabric screen.
Okay, wait, Stuart, before you go, before you go there, a couple quick questions. One is Drew Nielsen, or no, Barfel is asking, what is this future image that's the last parameter that you're judging here?
Here's the thing. Before I got ready for our podcast today, I was talking to a couple of my friends that are members of the Society of the Crossed Keys, if you're familiar with the Grand Budapest Hotel, a very secret society. Okay, well, it's just a funny thing. It's a secret society. I called a couple of calibrators. I needed something to happen in New York and was seeing if I could make it happen. And so I'm talking to Jim Doolittle and Kevin Miller. And, Jim says,
and
we're talking about theaters. We all three went to see Dunkirk at different places. They both saw it at 15 perf IMAX theaters, the Lincoln Center for in Kevin's case. And Jim saw it. I don't remember. Providence, Rhode Island. There's an IMAX 15 perf. They had it set up there. So, and what we said, Jim said it very specifically. It's amazing how far we have to travel to find a theater that's as good as what we have at home. So if you do things right, you get there. So the future comment that I put down there has to do with when content converts to native 4K, is this technology capable of dealing with it without any compromises? So when you're looking at screens, Stuart recently did a measurement of their screens, and they've got a little, I think they did a press release, 16K plus, because they measured the limiting resolution of StudioTech 100 on a 10-foot wide screen, and it was over 16K. So they were able to put the line pair density on that screen and resolve it beyond 16K, which makes sense. 70-millimeter film is how they started in life. They're celebrating their 70th year in the cinema business. And when 70-millimeter started to hit, they were the go-to company, and they've been dealing with high resolution on the government side as well. It's easy to do high resolution on a 50-foot wide screen, but try getting that kind of density on a 10-foot wide screen. That separates the men from the boys. And that, so what I'm referring to there is when we get that higher resolution stuff, is there a compromise? A fabric screen. In fact, if we go back, the next screen is going to be a fabric screen, I think. And it's got bigger issues, and it will be less prepared for 4K native content because of the light scatter of individual pixels, which is a unavoidable artifact of an uneven surface. And weave is by definition an uneven surface.
Right. So, and I should point out, make sure everybody understands that we're talking about acoustically transparent screens here. In the previous case, it was perforated, as Stuart typically does. In the case of Screen Research and some other companies, they do it with a woven material. It's like a fabric, as you mentioned. And the little tiny holes between the threads that are woven into this fabric are enough to let sound through. So you do get the acoustic transparency, which is what you want if you're going to put your speakers behind the screen, as they do in the commercial cinemas. But it gives you other problems, which is what we're talking about here.
Right on. So, okay, let's wrap up on screens real quick. We'll go down to that fabric one, and I think you'll see how the numbers compare there. Scroll on down. Is there something below that, Josh, or am I fooling you?
No, there's nothing below it.
Yeah, well, then let's leave that.
Okay, that's the last one.
Let's leave that one. You'll just have to trust me on that. So let's go to the projectors one, and we'll spend less time on that. There's not that much.
Yeah, that's called projector CSMS. There you go.
Right. Okay, so reduce that just a little bit, Josh, and then scroll on down, and we'll look at the things that matter in projectors from a cinema perspective. And again, so the parameters, you know, there's a total experience. Okay, that's a little bit of flat. Go back up. Flat field uniformity, number one. Okay, a white field color purity. Those are related. So if you can put a full white raster up on the screen, do you see? Now look at a perfect screen. It's Studio Tech 100 now, and it's the projector that will make the difference between corner brightness and center brightness, because projectors can have a uniformity problem. Their problem is usually more of a modeling, like an LCD flat panel, where you see, you know, the white is really more cloudy. You see darker and lighter sections all around the screen, all throughout the screen. And if you move from peak brightness to a gray, a middle gray, a dark gray, and a black, you'll see that cloudy sky looks different at those different luminance levels. And that's projection technology. Very important in cinema. And it's one reason there's only two technologies that have been standardized for digital cinema, which is DLP and SXRD. Let's go back
to that. SXRD being a version of LCOS, or liquid crystal on silicon.
That's correct.
Okay, moving back to that.
Back to the graphic, to that. And we'll scroll on down. So adjacent pixel contrast and the modulation transfer function, pixels per screen height, uncompressed full raster dynamic range. That means that's the way cinema looks at sequential contrast. You have to hit cinema's light levels, and you have to hit cinema's black levels. And 0.03 foot Lamberts is the reference for black. So that's their standard. We're doing better than that now with laser projectors. In fact, DLPs have migrated upward since they did that spec. That spec is close to 10 years old now. I think the original DCI document might have been 2007 or 8 in that neighborhood. They did an addendum. So those are the standards. And now let's go back. We'll look at a couple of projectors, and we'll just resolution limits. So here's just a DCI, you know, this is a DCI reference level DLP projector. It's like the SnowMat. It's the cinema's reference, so it pegs all. It's as good as the technology is today. So you go on down.
Therefore, it by definition, it's all 10s.
It's all 10s. It's all 10s. So, and then go on down, and I think what are we looking at here? Blue laser, DCI reference, same thing, basically with different lamps. There really doesn't seem to be much of a compromise going to the blue laser or the RGB laser relative to xenon, and mercury is a little bit of a compromise. Let's move out of this one now. I mean, you know, now you're getting a little bit of
Before we do, this is the next one is SXRD. You mentioned that as the other technology, 4K projection, which is basically from Sony. And here we see some compromises.
Yeah, and so the DLP manufacturers are going to say hooray for John, and Sony's going to say what a jackass John is. And they would both be right. So this was my bias. So I look at flat field uniformity, and you know, the SXRDs can make a white field, and they can do some sort of pre-distortion to correct for uniformities. But their issue is that their chips are analog. So they can have a little different gain pixel to pixel from pixel 1 to pixel 2 million or pixel 8 million if it's 4K in this case for each chip. Like transistors have a little different gain. So then when they're mated on the screen in the RGB world and now you try to make white, you might see a little color come through. You'll see a little hint of red in an area or green in an area. And they vary. So you can see bad ones and you can see great ones. And I have seen great ones. So it's not like that it's an intrinsic problem. It's something to look for. And it is an issue to be cognizant of. Flat field uniformity and white field purity is, you know, DLP has a little advantage there.
Before we go on, Barfel has a question. Are projectors ever calibrated to compensate for screen deficiencies or vice versa? I'm particularly thinking of flat field uniformity, but of course other parameters might also be compensated for.
They used to be. CRTs used to have zones where you could change the luminance to really it was because there was a red, green, and blue gun spread out horizontally. And to make it really uniform on the screen, I'd say it was more the projector that you were trying to fix than the screen. But typically, you know, what a calibration is accounting for the screen. Otherwise, you could just deliver the projector calibrated. But the screen is what's creating the light that your eye sees. It's reflected. And you also have a lamp. And there's, you know, especially the xenon lamps have a parabolic reflector. And you can you can improve the uniformity by adjusting the position of the lamp. That's a mechanical adjustment that the projector goes through on site. When you're setting up a projector for the first time on a screen, and it has something to do with the throw distance, how far you are from the screen. But that does account for uniformity on the screen. You can't undo a screen's problem if it's a uniformity issue. I don't know of a clean way to do that, but somebody could correct me. Okay, let's wrap up. I think we might be wrapped up there, and we can look at how these numbers apply. Go back to that graphic and just see what we got, Josh. I think we kind of covered it.
We got a couple of barcodes.
Yeah, well, then I'm just being a shill. Well, this is 1080. So 1080 versus 4K is an issue. But I would say let's move to – so we did screens and projectors. Let's look at – at projectors, let's look at actual cinemas. So let's start with commercial cinemas, and we'll run through there. So
that's pro cinema evaluations.
There you go. Okay, and this will just cruise through because this is me applying that rationale in a fairly, you know, I can't walk in and do the measurements that I do in a residential environment. But moving on, so let's move down. So the rankings for reference cinemas. So that's just a cover page, you might say. So you can keep going.
Keep going down. There we go.
Okay, so here's the Academy Theater. Oh. And this is actually a screening. Ang Lee did a presentation of the nominated Academy Award for Best Picture movies in a foreign language category. So I was able to look at images and judge from the back of the room something about this theater. It's a reference theater. All you have to do is look at the specs for the projection and screen and so forth. So if you move down, how did I rank the system? I gave it a 95. You know,
That's pretty darn good.
Just as good as a reviewer in a magazine. Go ahead and scroll down because we'll just look at other theaters. You know how I feel about that one. Cinepolis is that so there's a couple of screenshots from the one in I think that's West LA. And of course I gave that a 94. You know, it doesn't have quite the scale of the Samuel Golden. And look at can I say there's a little bit of arbitrary factor here, but my impression of that space is it's very, very good. So it's up
there
at
the reference
level.
You're just, you're acting like a reviewer of a product. You're just reviewing the entire theater.
You might say, yeah. So, yeah. All right, keep scrolling on down. We'll just get a look at a few theaters. This is out in Palm Springs. This is the Palm d'Or Theater. This theater was built by industry people from the movie industry, so that when they're hanging out in Palm Springs, they've got a place that they can go. And I walked in just to check out that theater. It's a white screen, native scope, full masking. And I walked in, whatever movie was playing was what I was going to see. It was 12 Years a Slave. What a movie. I mean, not only was the intensity there, but that's just like that Breaking the Waves, the Lars von Trier movie. The heart-wrenching scenes were relieved with scene transitions that were the most beautiful photography you will ever see, you know, of fields of flowers and things like that. So that was an amazing movie, but that was a good house. I think I gave that a 93. So move on down. It's just places that I either was convenient. Yeah. So here's the Cinerama Dome. So that's a reference theater. So the scale is up there in Hollywood. Gave it a 91. It's a 90 something, 95 foot wide screen, scope screen, phenomenal. And they do a wonderful job. So, you know, I'm splitting hairs, but if you move on down, again, light levels were an issue. I was there, and John Stig, I think, is the guy who's in charge of all of the Pacific theaters in Southern California, and that theater specifically is very well known in the cinema world. Guy, you know, worldwide. He gave me a little tour, and he said, you know, this is 3D, but one of our projectors has died, so it's only about 3 foot Lamberts.
Oh man. Normally, in a normal commercial cinema, you want a peak brightness of about 14 foot Lamberts. And so when you go to a 3D cinema and you're looking through the glasses, you might see 3 or 4 foot Lamberts. But you're saying it was only three foot Lamberts in 2D.
You should see 5 or 6. And that's with a pair of projectors. And when they had one projector down, they saw half that. So it was a fairly dim 3D presentation.
No kidding.
So I didn't stay and watch it. Okay, let's move on down, and we'll cover those, and we'll move over to the residential.
Residential, right?
Okay, so this is the Chinese theater. This is before the IMAX conversion. No, it's after. This is after. This was the AFI Film Festival and the screening of August Osage County. Those are that's the cast and director after the showing. But you see, it's masked, so they masked it properly. It's a scope format movie. And Scott, you had the projectionist for the what is now the TCL Theater on your show, and he told a story that I was amazed by. But they'll have premieres there. It's a major place for Hollywood premieres. And sometimes the studio will bring a white screen in for the one premiere showing. Right?
Wow. Because it's a silver screen. Is it a silver screen now?
It was a silver screen. I think it's still a silver screen. I think they still – yeah, it's IMAX. It has to be. They use a polarized 3D system.
Well, except for the fact that that's now IMAX laser.
And well, they could have changed the
laser
screen.
They don't need the silver screen anymore. I have to check with Thomas. Thomas Larson is the projectionist, and I need to get him back on the show to
get him back on and have a post conversion 6P laser conversation with him. I'd love to hear it.
Exactly.
Now I don't know that IMAX did convert to Dolby Vision spectral.
No, 3D, they did not. Well, they converted to spectral 3D. No, they use 6P laser, two projectors with these sort of like Dolby Vision glasses, Dolby 3D glasses, I should say, where the two projectors are showing red, green, and blue, but they're slightly different wavelengths of red, green, and blue from one and from the other. And then that can be reflected off a white screen, doesn't need to be silver, doesn't need to be polarization preserving. And it comes back, and one of the glasses filters out one set of red, green, and blue, and the other one filters out the other set of red, green, and blue.
Then those glasses are color. The lenses are color, and that would tell you. If the lenses look like sunglasses, it's polarized. If they look like color, you know, like a rose color, then it's a color filtering system.
Right. Cool. So the new IMAX laser projector at the TCL Chinese is color spectrum separation is what it's called. Yep. And so they don't need a silver screen anymore. I think they might have replaced it with a white screen.
That screen and put a white screen in there. That would be good. So get the guy on and we'll find out.
All right.
Okay, let's move on to highly rated theater, gave that a 90. And this is sort of a collection of the big rooms. So the XD Theater. And out here we have a Cinemark XRD Theater, I think is what they call theirs. I think I've got that right. But it's Cinemark. And it's a reference house. I mean, we travel 100 miles to go see movies at that theater. We know the projectionist. He's a very good guy. And they did it right there. It's a purpose-built new theater. Okay, let's move on. That might be the last page. I'm not sure. Let's see what we got. Okay, this is the – that's redundant. Move on. And this is IMAX in general. This is 2K IMAX in the big rooms. Okay, so this is the 143.
Well, in a Cineplex, opposed to the IMAXs at like museums and stuff.
Yeah, and I was disparaging of that when they first did it. And some of them are good and some of them are really this bad. But everything's gotten better over time, so I won't I won't dwell on their, their issues there. Go up a little bit so we can see those graphs. No, up. Other way. The other up.
Another down.
Stop. No, I meant the little boat. The other little boat. Okay. This is this is from the patent paper of IMAX digital Cineplex conversions. So the drawing on the left shows a conventional Cineplex with slope seating and a screen. And the one on the right says, make the screen floor to ceiling. Move it closer to the seats. Now nobody can see the bottom of the screen. So make it stadium seating. And that's the patent. That's literally right from the patent paper. And that's what you'll find. You'll walk into theaters where the last row is 1.5 screen heights away from the screen or even less. Their spec is 42 degrees vertical field of view for the last row on the patent paper. So, let's move on up and see what else we got. Showcase Center. Okay. Scott, this is why we didn't need that document called Casablanca. I see color in black and white. I've got it right here. The image in the right corner is a shot of Casablanca in a theater. And that red and that green stuff is what I was talking about. That projector, even though it had been visited weeks before, just didn't have white field uniformity. You won't see that in a color movie. You've got to have a pretty trained eye to see the problem in a color movie. But in a black and white movie, it sticks out like a sore thumb. And that's the issue you want to watch out for.
Yep.
Okay, let's move on down. And I think that's why I ranked theater so low. It's a beautiful theater, but it was they just had problems.
Or white field uniformity,
Yeah, so is that the last
in the time we... In the time we have left, let's make sure we talk about residential.
And that's in that. Let's go right to it. Okay, it's CSMS residential. The word residential will be in the title.
Or resi, actually, R-E-S-I.
Resi, okay, good enough. That will bring us to the... We're rounding third. We'll slide into home.
Here we go.
So this is, I call this a cinema... standard metric system. Actually, Runco introduced CSMS years ago. We had press releases on it so that we were looking at specs on projectors after they were calibrated to the standard, REC 709, 602, whatever, because otherwise the specs meant nothing. And luminance was the one that was so distorted. So if we look at what matters, the parameters, it's similar stuff. But the viewing geometry and the cinematic scale is number one. As I said last week and probably back in November, Scott, it's the first principle. You've got to get the viewing geometry right. That's based on screen height. After that, if you've got a constant height design, you'll have no problem. If it's a constant width design, well, all of a sudden, scope content doesn't meet your criteria for viewing geometry because you threw 30% of the viewing geometry away. So aspect ratio management and format masking is number two. Get the size right and mask it, And now you've got a chance for a relatively perfect presentation. The first compromise people make, understandably, is the masking, because it can be expensive. I can sell a 15-foot wide screen for a few grand, or, you know, whatever, $5,000, whatever the number is. And if you want side masking VistaScope, you get to spend 18 or 20 instead. And that's just the mechanism and control system and all that jazz. It's the beautiful and right thing to do. I can't afford it, hence my manual curtains behind me. And
which you know, your wife that, made for you, custom made.
She did a fine job. She's been sewing for me for 45 years this year, our anniversary.
All right. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah.
All right. Let's keep going through this last bit document here.
Okay. So canvas purity, you know, the viewing space, go up a little bit, other way a little bit, Scott. Sorry, I mean, Josh. Viewing space and hardware level. Rava is this new concept by Theo, and basically he's curating cinemas, which means we're home cinemas. We're addressing those specs, right? So those standards are the ones, and I'm on the advisory board to help, you know, hold their feet to that fire, that they're meeting the standards according to what cinema wants. And then we pick hardware, screens, surround processors, you know, Trinoff and Acuras and so forth, that do immersive audio, amplifiers, loudspeakers that meet the standard. And if we're able to get to the audio page, we'll talk a little bit about that. Let's move on down, and we can see actual theaters now, and see how the numbers come out. So if we go to one, I think is maybe one I've shown before, it's a good example. Move on down further. It's the 100-point system. And this one is, so this is the Phoenix system. I gave it a 96. The viewing geometry, the screen material, the projection technology, the execution. I take the audio into account. So this is now an immersive audio system. That's the approach. And there's my, I've got to show you my wine. Okay. So I present them with a ceremonial wine. So here it is. This is Coppola Director's Cut Cinema. So
that's really cool.
You can see that. It's a very cool bottle of wine. And that's the very best. You know, you can still do good. And if you do, you get Coppola's King Kong. And if you're somewhere in between, for you, Technicolor. This is Coppola's Technicolor, Wizard of Oz. So
that's cool.
The schmaltz I use with my dealer and end users. I've given it to billionaires, and a little tear comes to their eye when I give them the story and how, you know, how happy we are to have the opportunity to build fine theaters. They're the ones that make it possible. So, okay, let's move to some more theaters. Moving on down, this is their theater. So you can see the execution, the technology, all of that stuff. That's one of the calibrators I had in from Runco. That happened to be a Runco execution some years back. Keep moving on down, and we'll see a few more. We can make it almost like a movie, 24 frames a second. Here's how I rank in, you know, categorically. So again, I give thought and take measurements, and we're going to get to the benchmarking one. I'm not sure how much time we have left, but if we can, you'll see how
almost
I actually
none.
Look at test patterns. Looks like you're going to have me back again, Scott, but it ain't next week, I can assure you.
No.
Here's how their theater maps out relative to the Samuel Goldwyn. That's a very important part of figuring out that their viewing geometry is right on. So they've got a 2-height and a 3-height viewing position in their 2 rows. So it's a compact theater, but it's very cinematic. You can. Mm-hmm. It's a good review room, and keep on going down further. And okay, this is another 96 done differently. This is a 16-foot wide screen. Keep scrolling down, and down you go, and down you go, and you see there's the technology, there's the ranking. I gave this a 95. Down you go further, and you'll see it's a 3. Here's the rankings. It's 3 rows, and the screen is 7 feet high. The first row is 12 feet.
Go down a little farther. We'll see the diagram of the floor plan, I think.
Yes, quite right. And that's the beauty. This is a really no-compromise viewing experience room, because there's a row that's very close. That's 1.5 screen heights. It's 12 feet from a 7-foot high image. Constant width, so 16 feet wide in scope. That's very cinematic. And then you've got a row 18 feet back and a row 24 feet back. I'm so proud of this design, driven by the end user and the integrator, Maverick Integration. They fit that in a 26-foot room. Mm. Right? So the room was built purposely for this theater, and they did it well. That's a very good example of getting things right. Side masking and all of those parameters that I think are important, they rung the bell on. So mm-hmm, you can good. Keep going to the extent we have more time. This is a reference theater where I'm measuring the viewing geometry with my gun sitting in row 2. We hadn't actually locked down the seating positions yet in this theater. And the homeowner, who is a real enthusiast that's been doing theaters since the CRT days, twin 9-inch gun projectors in his first theater, just a no-compromise guy. And mm-hmm. viewing geometry was critical, and row 1 was for him. And we literally were moving them back and forth. We went up to the screen and looked at it, and then stepped back so that where the pixel density disappeared. And then we said, now the viewing geometry can be considered, because you're not going to see artifacts. And we locked the seating down. And if you go further, you'll see what the viewing geometry was, driven by the preference of this end user in the design of the theater. Mm-hmm. And it's very cinematic. So,
Yeah, let's keep going down here. So you've created a bunch of very high-end, very high-performing home cinemas that conform to the rating system that you've developed to be as close as possible. And these are all into the 90s.
Stop there, Josh. I think that's a good stopping point. So you can see he's got, good, better, best, or small, medium, large, however you want to look at it, related to a professional space designed by the people who make the movies. It's hard to do better than that, and his preference was factored in. So that row, if you ask me, I'd stick a row in front of row 1, but that would be slightly crazy, 1.25 screen heights back. But nonetheless, mm-hmm. that room is a spectacular room at every level. And that's a room with an opaque screen and the sound system flanking the screen. No acoustical transparency whatsoever. The highest resolution you can possibly get in the image.
Mm-hmm. So I think to sort of summarize here, because we are kind of out of time, really, if you're thinking about doing a home cinema, you want to consider all of these factors that you have outlined here for us today and try to maximize them. Get them as close to that 10 as you possibly can in order to replicate the home cinema, the commercial cinema experience at home as closely as possible, right?
Exactly right. And, we're not talking about audio, but of course it's just as important. And I will say, Paul Hales was on your show, another guy you had back twice in a row because the content kind of, begged that. His philosophy is right on. And if you have a 1-inch dome at every location, you can't do cinema levels. Cinema levels require 105 dB constant 2/3 back in the room. And in cinema, they have to be able to do that for 2 hours straight. That's part of the measuring test. Well, you'll heat voice coils and compress, and that's why hi-fi based audio systems always seem like they're on the edge, because they are. So systems like the James loudspeaker system with their quad tweeter array, Procella, which uses a waveguide with compression drivers to get that horsepower into the room. I think, Wisdom does it by using line arrays, a planar dynamic, very tall speaker that puts a cylindrical wavefront into the room so it doesn't decay as fast, 3 dB per doubling of distance instead of 6. There are a lot of ways to do it, but you have to think about that uniformity in the space and hitting the levels. Not that you need to hit the levels, but you're not going to duplicate the art if you're not able to, and in trying to, if you compress. Dynamic compression is the worst thing. It's the worst in the image. Modulated irises and local dimming on TVs, That's dynamic compression. It ruins the art, if you ask me. And audio compression in loudspeakers is probably the number one problem in sound system design, especially if your room's a little larger. If your room is, you know, is you know, 12 by 15, 8-foot ceiling, you can maybe compromise a bit. But you still need the dynamics. My room's not large, and if you look at my front wall, I've got the I've got 20 one-inch domes addressing the front stage, right? I will not compress. I'm distributing the power and the dynamics over that much space. And that's at least 12 dB more than a hi-fi speaker could approach.
Wow. Well, you know what? We're going to have you come back to talk about the audio, because that's yet another critical component, as you said. And you started to allude to it here, but we're out of time, I'm sorry to say. So will you come back?
We've ended
will you come back and talk about audio?
Three times. I will send you an outline, maybe November or December, whatever's good, when you've got some downtime, and I'll be prepared where we're just talking about audio in an efficient way. I'll have some graphics that'll help it run efficiently for you.
Excellent. Well, it's been just chock full of interesting information today, and I want to thank you so much for being here for part two, or part three, really, based on what we talked about back in November, and come back again for part four, and we'll talk about audio. That would be just awesome. We'll thank you.
Be happy to.
Great. That's John Bishop. You can email him if you have any questions at jbishop@b-accurate.com. You can always find me online at avsforum.com, and you can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg, or on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/HomeTheaterGeeks. Next week, John and I and tens of thousands of our closest friends will be at the Cedia Trade Show. And so what we're going to do is we're going to pre-record Home Theater Geeks for next week. That will be tomorrow, Friday, September 1st, from 2:30 to 3:30 p.m. Pacific time. My guest will be headphone guru Tile Hertzens. And he's very interested in answering questions from listeners. So I do hope you will be able to join us. That is tomorrow, Friday, September 1st, 2:30 to 3:30 p.m. Pacific time. And come into the chat room and post questions for Tile about headphones. And he will be very happy to answer them. That's what he asked if we could do. And I said, of course, happy to. So I do hope you will join us for that. Until then, geek out.